Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. This week on the HR Power Hour, we have two great guests, and they are the Commissioner of the Maine Department of Labor, Jean Paquette, and of course, Pam McGafflin, Director of the Bureau of Labor Standards. And today we're going to be talking about the Fair Labor Standard Act changes, or the FLSA changes that are happening. This affects everyone, and it's going to be a great show. We're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. Today we're talking with Commissioner Jean Paquette from the Maine Department of Labor and Pam McGafflin, Director of the Bureau of Labor Standards. Welcome, both of you, back to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. It's nice to be here.
Oh, well, you know, there's not really much happening out there in the world today, right? I mean, it's a pretty quiet thing. There's nothing going on at the Department of Labor. It's pretty boring, you know. All right, so let's get serious. So there's actually a lot happening. And certainly the first thing that's on everybody's mind, and I've purposely been waiting to talk about this on the air, because, you know, the FLSA, the Fair Labor Standards Act, has been talked about for about 6-8 months now nationally, because everybody was waiting. We're waiting for what could possibly happen. Maybe it's going to come in at $50,000 for an average non-exempt salary person. Maybe it isn't. What's the number? What's it going to happen? Well, we now know the answers. We now know what's going to happen. So what I'd like to do is have like a candid conversation today of, A, what are the facts? How does this work for like for the average Mainer? What is this, you know, what does this really mean? What are we really talking about? And try to help employers think about ways to deal with this issue. Okay, So that's where we're going to start today. You go okay with that? They both say yes. They're both smiling. That's good.
Sounds good.
All right, so first, I'll go, Commissioner, talk to us a little bit about what are the rules, what are exactly happening in terms of the Fair Labor Standards Act.
Okay. As people have been discussing the fact that they've been waiting for the rule to finally come out, the rule finally came out and it will take effect December 1st of this year. The rule basically states that if you have classified your employee as an exempt employee from overtime, even though they may be paid in salary or they are paid on salary, salary is a method of payment. What we need to focus on is whether you classify them as exempt from being able to get overtime or not. The threshold for many years has been $23,660. So if an employee was considered exempt, if they were classified as exempt, if they made any more than $23,660, they would be exempt from overtime. So that was the low threshold. What the new rule is saying is that now they have moved that threshold to $47,476. And what that means is that if you're going to be exempt from overtime from the law, you have to make more than $47,476 a year. But it's better to say, really, that you have to make more than $913 a week. Because if you focus just on a full year salary, it doesn't necessarily take into account those seasonal jobs that they have exempt employees that they pay on a weekly basis. So what we're trying to educate all employers on is the fact that it is critical before December 1st to do a number of things that will help determine whether or not you are classifying your employees correctly. How do you do that? You have to look at more than just the job description and the title of the positions. That is important, but it is not the test. The test is the duties test. What exactly do these employees do? And there are exemptions for overtime, which there's three exemptions of overtime. Executive exemption, administrative exemptions, and professional exemptions. So what we need, or those are the main three.
Main three, yes.
So that's what we have to, we have to educate the employers on what those are. Employers have to talk to their advisors, whether they be their employment attorneys or if they're some HR advisors, such as what Career Management Associates do, so that you can stay in compliance. And the big, larger companies have really started to work on that. It affects a lot of them. But we're concerned with the small to mid-sized companies that don't necessarily have HR professionals on staff and may not have taken a close look at this through many, many years, over many years.
Well, you know, that's true. It's interesting. We certainly work with a lot of small businesses, family-owned businesses especially.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I got to tell you, I'm still running into individuals who are not aware of this. And it would almost seem impossible to believe based upon the amount of news coverage and the media that's out there. But I'm still running into people who don't completely either have vaguely heard of it or really don't even acknowledge what it really is or don't really understand it, and they're just doing their thing, right? I mean, they're not doing it maliciously. They just don't necessarily understand. So, Pam, tell me a little bit about what the type of calls you're receiving. What, you know, what are some of the questions that are coming in? And certainly add on to whatever the commissioner is saying here in terms of some of the things you're seeing.
Sure. I think one of the biggest concerns employers are dealing with right now is the total impact. They're trying to assess the how many employees that they're going to really have to focus on. And the advice that we're giving them is from the compliance side is that they need to really look at all employees that they pay salary, because unfortunately what happens is that you might have that occasional employee who they've always paid on a salary, and then through this review they realize that they don't fit into one of those exemptions that the commissioner has just mentioned, that executive, that professional, or that administrative. And that's a whole separate issue, because I mean that just means that they've been misclassified and they should have been receiving overtime during any time that they've been working over 40. But we'll leave that on a separate issue. So the first thing that employers should be doing right now, especially those small, mid-sized employers, is trying to identify those employees who they currently pay on a salary and look to see where they're at on their salary threshold. I mean, the current threshold right now is $455 a week, and it's going up to, as the commissioner said, $913 a week. And so they're going to have to look at that the job duties that individual performs and see if it is cost effective for the business to raise that individual up to 913 or reclassify them to a non-exempt position and pay them on an hourly rate of pay and potentially time and a half for any hours they work over 40. But there are ways to – I mean, you can actually keep that same employee on a salary, but there's just ways to compute that salary and still meet the overtime requirement as well, as long as you keep that guaranteed salary. We can go into that a little bit deep, but that's really in the weeds on how to compute the overtime for that. Going back to what the commissioner said about, you know, the key issues, I mean, the major issue is the salary threshold. I mean, that is a huge increase of like 113% from 455 to 913. That is probably the biggest concern, and unfortunately, Department of Labor cannot assist employers on how to address the financial shortfall that they might be experiencing if they had to raise everybody up to 913. I mean, that's something that the Department of Labor can address. And how the Department of Labor is actually coming into this is we need to keep in mind that it's USDOL that made these rule changes. And as a result, the Maine Department of Labor, through statute, is required to adopt the higher salary threshold should it – under law, I mean, currently state law says that you have to pay 3,000 times the current minimum wage or the salary threshold established by USDOL, whatever is greater. Obviously, 913 will be greater than 3,000 times the minimum wage. So we will have to adopt that 913 salary. So we would have the dual enforcement as well as USDOL. So it will impact us come December 1st as well.
You know, so we're talking about a bunch of different things here. So we're talking about, first of all, the basic, right? It's going from 455 to 913. That's a simple number, simple to understand. Mm-hmm. We're then talking about, and you brought it up, Gene, in regards to salary versus hourly. Mm-hmm. And there is this is to both your points, this confusion about salary versus non-exempt, and that salary is just a method of payment, and that non-exempt or exempt is really where the question is. That's
correct,
really
correct.
What the question is.
Right.
So, and I don't, either one of you can take this, but kind of just could you break down the difference specifically to make people understand what that real difference is between a non-exempt and an exempt person?
Okay. When you're talking about somebody who's paid on a salary, as you pointed out, David, salary is just a method of payment, as the commissioner pointed out. The true answer to the question is the duties that they perform, and Commissioner Paquette highlighted this too. Out of those three major exemptions, that executive, professional, administrative, there's at least two parts to that. One, obviously, as we've talked about, is the guaranteed salary, but the other part is a duties test. And it's okay to pay somebody a guaranteed salary, but if they do not meet the duties test for any of those exemptions, then they truly are non-exempt, and you're just paying the person on a salary. The most common, we'll use the easiest exemption, the executive exemption, is kind of like the manager exemption. And under that exemption, you have to, your primary duty has to be management. You have to supervise at least two full-time employees or the equivalent, like four part-time employees, and then you have to be paid on that guaranteed salary currently at $455. So let's say somebody's paid $750 a week right now, but their primary duty is not management and they don't supervise anybody. The employer could be paying them on a salary, but they really don't quite meet that exemption. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's an example of one
sure.
exemption.
Sure. So just drill down for just a second. So somebody's a manager. They're working in at a Dunkin' Donuts. They're running a Dunkin' Donuts manager. I'm going to break this down a little bit more specific. So they are managing a team of three or four people that are on the counter. They're running whatever they do. During certain times of the day, they have to actually work the counter, because it's busy in the morning, it's busy for certain times, especially, I would say, in the morning time. Mm-hmm. My understanding, and I'm open to being corrected if I'm wrong, is that as long as the manager duties equate to 50% or 51% or a little bit over whatever that 50% is, that is approximately where the duties test falls, that at least their duties are 50% more. Or does it say that their predominant duties, and there's no percentile behind that, in terms of what their management is? What's the test today?
Sure. Under federal law, it doesn't have a percentage. It just says that their primary duty has to be management. Under state law, it does not give a percentage either, but however, in our rules, we do define a 50% threshold in there. However, I will say that if you read the full rule, the whole paragraph, don't get stuck on the first couple sentences that say 50%. It says that the percentile should not be the deciding factor, that you have to consider everything that the employee is doing. So based on your example, you have, let's say, a manager or assistant manager working at Dunkin' Donuts, and because the person is multitasking and be able to help out with the drive-thru, run the front counter, grab a few donuts, make a cup of coffee, that type of stuff, while they're truly their management their primary duty is still managing. I mean, they have complete control of the floor at that point in time. They would still qualify for the exemption. They're just an exceptional employee that can multitask.
Okay. So that's exactly what I was hoping to hear, because that's the question we get a lot of. And I think, correct, we know the federal standard doesn't technically have a percent, and neither does the state. However, there is this rule, and it does talk about this 50%, and that's where the confusion really, I think, is in the rulemaking versus, it'd be great to clarify that rule, because that's exactly where the trouble is in terms of that first couple lines when I talk about
it.
Okay.
I want to just mention one thing.
Sure.
And that is, when we think about salary, this is where some of the confusion comes in. When we think about paying people on a salary, we think of it as an automatic exemption. But if you think about it differently and say, does the duties test fall under executive, administrative, and professional, they must be paid on a salary basis. And I think that's where you get the confusion. Exempt has to be paid on a salary. Salary does not necessarily mean you're exempt.
No, that's a very good clarification in regards to understanding that. So as we're talking about, you know, there are people who are going to be making over the $913 a week who are still going to be hourly because?
Well, that's where some of the confusion comes in. People all along think that if they're being paid a salary, they're automatically exempt. What people have to do is think about what are the duties that that person performs. Because the exemption, if you are exempt by the executive, the administrative, and the professional exemption, you must be paid on a salary basis. So instead of thinking of it as the person that I've hired is a salaried person, You really have to look at the duties of that person and then determine the whether or not they're exempt or non-exempt, and then figure out what method of payment you want to use.
So it really is the duties test that makes the determination in terms of this. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB on 100.5 FM, and we will be right back. If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
Guys, when you buy your clothes at DXL, you look good. But you feel like a rock star. So if you want to look and feel like a... You'll find all the brands you love, waist size 38 and up, all in one awesome store. DXL, you're looking good. Right now, Harbor Bay long sleeve tees are just $29.99 each when you buy two or more.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. And we're talking with Jean Paquette, the Commissioner of the Maine Department of Labor, and Pam McGafflin, Director of the Bureau of Labor Standards. And we're talking about the FLSA, Federal Labor Standards Act.
Fair Labor Standards Act.
You see, you're confusing me, Pam. It's okay. Pam's confusing me here. And you can put that on the air. It's okay. She's confusing me. It's all good. No, we're all having fun. All right. So we've been talking about the duties test. We've been talking about the changes that are happening. Maine law. Mm-hmm. In this. So let's talk about a little about the Maine law part of this. Because, as you said, Pam, Maine law mirrors federal law with some exceptions.
Correct.
All right? So let's talk about those exceptions. Let's talk about what exactly is happening with that in terms of it. And where we're going from here. We have to December 1 to iron out all the kinks. Talk to us about that.
Sure. So to recap again, I don't know if we actually touched on all four highlights of the new rules, but we've talked about the salary threshold change. We've talked about that the salary will now, every 3 years, that threshold will be automatically updated.
Nope, we didn't talk about the fact that every 3 years it's going to be updated.
It will
to
be.
The 40th percentile.
Benchmark, yes, that's established. And it's established based on the salary weekly earnings of the lowest paid region of the U.S., which is traditionally around the Delta region, which is kind of like your Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas area. And so every 3 years that will be automatically updated. I've had employers say, how much notice will they get on that? And of course, you know, I'm speaking on behalf of USDL, which I really can't, but I'm going to make that assumption that they're trying to going to give us some type of leeway. But it's because it's automatically, they're going to give some, you know, warning beforehand, and we have no clue what that is. You know, what the new salary threshold in 2020, I heard it's going to be over 1,000, 1,050, something to that extent, but that's just a guess. But so you have the salary threshold that will be automatically updated, and then there's two other changes. One is the highly compensated employees. That's already something that's recognized under USDOL. The threshold for that is $100,000, and that will be increasing to $134,000. Also on December 1st. And then there's this new thing that USDOL has never recognized before, and that is basically a carve-out that allows employers to offset 10% of the guaranteed salary as long as the employee is paid on some form of commission or non-discretionary bonus that they can offset that 10% of. And so that's another thing that's allowed.
Yeah, so it's 10% of what? Is it 10% of the person's salary, or is it 10% of the bonus or commission that they could be earning?
Great question. I'm not sure if I actually have the answer to that. I'm going to assume, without doing a little bit further research, I'm going to assume that, you know, when they say offset, I mean, you can't claim a higher offset than what's allowed under the law. So if the salary threshold's 913, I'm going to assume that you can take no more than 10% off the 913. So we're talking $91.30, which might seem like, you know, not a lot of money, but over 52 weeks, $91.30 can add up.
Yeah, no, there's no question it can. And I think that's some of the questions people have, because this is a new part of the federal statute
right.
that says that they're basically allowing this percentage, which is not a bad thing. Right? I mean, it's actually a good thing. But is this guaranteed bonus, guaranteed commission? How does that play out, or has that been determined yet?
Well, right now we're looking at what the federal law is and what the state statutes and rules are, and we're analyzing all of those pieces. And as soon as we can get some information out there, we're going to do it. But we're right now trying to just get the information out with, you know, frequently asked questions and so forth. And I think getting into those questions about what's the 10% and what, you know, those kinds of weedy type of questions, yes, we're going to have information about that. But right now, I think, like, for the highly compensated employees, a lot of people out there don't understand what that means. I mean, what does that mean? And right now, it's a federal law that says if you're a highly compensated employee, which means over $100,000 and it's going up to $134,000, then you don't have to pay overtime to that highly compensated employee. Well, most likely, if you're making $100,000, you're most likely exempt, but not necessarily. So, yes, that is part of the federal rule. That's something that Maine at this point does not recognize. So we have to look at those things and really figure out how are we going to conform with the federal or the Fair Labor Standards Act, and what's going to change in our statute and what's going to change in our rules to be compatible and easily understood.
One of the questions that comes up sometimes is, will this change on the sales side? There is a sales exemption. And so a person who is on 100% commission, okay, somebody who does a sales role and just does that, gets no salary, gets no hourly wage, is totally paid on a per piece basis or a per sale basis. Mm-hmm. Are there any changes for that individual?
Under federal law, there is an outside sales exemption that's recognized by the FLSA that, and I'm going to paraphrase, that says as long as your duties, it has nothing to do with the payment method, as long as your duties fit into that square peg, square hole, I mean that you're predominantly doing all your sales outside of the business, that you don't, the employer doesn't control your location, it's not an inside sales job. While you might have to come into the office to follow up on your leads and so forth, it truly is an outside sales job. That nothing changes on the federal level on that part. They're not addressing anything on the outside sales. How that relates to state is we do have a blurb in our law as well that refers to sales, but it doesn't. It's not called outside sales, but the requirement on that one is that you have to be paid in commission in some form. So it could be full commission, base salary plus commission, and then you would be exempt from overtime. But that still differs from federal law. Federal law doesn't talk about the method of payment. You could be paid on a piece rate, a day rate, something to that extent. But if your duties you perform qualify you for that outside sales exemption, you would be qualified for to be exempt from overtime under the FLSA. But we would deny that exemption under Maine law because you have to be paid on commission. So, I mean, there's a lot of parts in the law under overtime. And while that's not even being addressed by these new rules, there's a lot of things that were, because as Commissioner Paquette said, we're going back over these to see the discrepancies and the differences between federal law and state law and try to clear up this muddy water that is just completely confusing to businesses as well as the agency as a whole.
So while this is certainly one of those shockers to some of the organizations out there because they're having such an increase, right? I mean, doubling or actually a little more than doubling. There is a benefit from the standpoint of people actually going to look at this a little tighter now and a little closer on that.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, one of the things you brought up, and I think this is a good point to talk about, is the misclassified worker, because that's the basis of the bottom line of all this, how somebody classified. So I'm an employer, and I'm currently have somebody who's classified as salary that maybe shouldn't be salary.
You mean exempt.
Exempt. Thank you. Exempt. What do I do? You know, so if I suddenly say, and this may be an opportunity for employers, by the way, to just simply go, because the rules were going to change, I can see that happening. Let's be realistic with that. But what's the proper procedure for someone who's misclassified someone for a few years? Heck, maybe even longer.
Yes, I think one of the things we need to do is first of all, not to say that misclassification is an incorrect term, but people need to realize that we don't want to confuse misclassification with reclassification. The misclassification has been talked about over the past few years when it comes to whether someone is an independent contractor or is an employee of that organization. With this new rule, we want to call it a reclassification because it is looking at actual duties, not whether or not they're an independent contractor versus an employee of the organization.
Okay. No problem. We will use the correct terms or the new terms, whatever the term is, reclassification.
So as we're talking about reclassification, to address your question, so let's say an employer is reviewing his 10, 15, 20 salaried employees and determining at that point in time if he or she wants to reclassify those employees who are formerly, as he or she claimed, salary exempt, and do they want to reclassify them as a non-exempt employee, which would obviously require overtime payments, that so forth. And in that study and that analysis, they come across one employee or two employees that they classified incorrectly, that they made that assumption, as so many people do, salary means no overtime, and realize that the duties that that individual performed really doesn't fit into one of those pre-existing exemptions that we've mentioned so much already. What would have to happen at that point in time is technically the employer is liable for back wages. If they classified them incorrectly and that person should have always been non-exempt, it's fine to pay them on a salary because, again, salary is just a method of payment. Under federal law, there's a 2-year statute of limitations under the FLSA. There's a 6-year statute of limitations under Maine statutes. So technically, the employer could be liable for 6 years of back wages to that employee if that employee had been employed for 6 years and working overtime. Now, the other thing is, just because somebody pays them on a salary, they might not have been working overtime. It's just a simple method so they don't have to worry about the record keeping. It's easier for tax purposes. It makes everything easier for the business side on the, you know, for payment and compensation. So if the employee was not working overtime, while they need to make sure that they classify that person correctly and keep records, because records would be a record requirement, would be a requirement for somebody who's non-exempt, there might be no harm, no foul, other than the fact that you just need to reclassify them correctly and make sure you maintain accurate records of hours worked from here on. And if they do work over 40, start paying them time and a half. Or if they're paid on a salary, then there are ways that you can satisfy the overtime requirement. If you want to get into that, we can give
the federal halftime in different ways.
Exactly, that, exactly.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, and not a lot of organizations know about that, to be honest with you. It is a legal method of payment.
Fluctuating workplace,
it is. And maybe I think it would be good. Let's just bring that up so people understand what that is. I think it's a good point.
Fluctuating work week, in short, is when you take a guaranteed salary, and again, it has to be guaranteed, not to confuse again with the salary exempt, but there's a requirement if you're only going to pay half-time compensation that you also have to pay out guaranteed salaries. So the simple math, because I can do it in my head, that I always use is, let's say you have an individual who is paid a guaranteed salary of $500 a week and they work 50 hours in that week. Well, the salary, because it's guaranteed and there's never no deductions ever made from that salary, then the salary is going to cover the straight time earnings required under the FLSA or under state law either. So that part's taken care of. What is still due is that half time, because overtime is time in one half. We've already paid for the time. The employees still just do the half. So in this week, we take total compensation, $500, divided by total hours worked, 50. You would get a regular rate of pay, which is $10 an hour. The halftime rate of 10 is 5. So right now we're paying the straight-time earnings of 500, which is the guaranteed salary, but they are still due the halftime rate. They work 10 hours of overtime, so 10 hours times 5, halftime rate is 50. So the employer would be in compliance if they paid that individual $550 for the week, because they paid the salary of straight-time and the halftime of the 50. And that is a legal way to pay overtime.
If somebody then works, just for the sake of argument, 61 or 62.
Right. It gets even more complicated.
Right.
Because if the expectation is told to the employee that you're paid $500 a week with the expectation that you're going to work 50 hours. And
I
so
meant
that,
51, 52. Well,
I understand.
Not 6,
it's okay.
Yep, yep.
Yeah, we don't want to give them 12 more extra hours.
No, that's it.
So if the expectation is that they're paid for $500 a week for a 50-hour work week, they can still take the halftime credit for the hours of, let's say, 41 up to 50. But in this week, if they end up working 51, 52, it's actually going to be time in one half for that those 2 extra hours because the salary was based on a 50-hour work week.
Right.
So.
Right. And a lot of people, you know, this is where it gets in the weeds. And
it does.
You know, and I
it
certainly
does.
Don't want to, you know, go into every potential, you know, situation. But these are the questions that are realistically being asked. How can I deal with this? How can I think of creative ways to help my organization pay for this, right? And federal halftime is a perfectly legitimate way to look at it.
Right.
In terms of
the only thing I caution is if you do not have the manpower to take on this type of burden of payroll compensation payout methodology, it can be very, very cumbersome because, you know, if you have, you know, a handful or hundreds of employees that you're paying this way, that's going to change each week based on the hours that individual works. So you're recalculating a regular rate of pay for every employee for every week. So, I mean, it's really time consuming. You better have a really good HRIS system going for it or a manual. It's just really time consuming. So.
No, absolutely. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB on 100.5 FM, and we will be right back. Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
So, Dave, would you say your lawn is army green or hunter green?
I'd say more shamrock green.
Wow, greenest green I've ever seen.
Thanks to new Ironite from Pennington. It's loaded with iron and turned my yellow lawn to green. Fast. It's a green machine.
I'm jealous. But that means more mowing.
No way. Ironite greens without the growth surge other fertilizers cause. So I relax and enjoy the green.
Well, I'm turning green with envy.
Better to turn green with Ironite.
New Ironite from Pennington. Turn your yellow lawn greener than green without extra mowing.
Geico applauds your inner road champion.
A solid bump from Geico's fist to yours goes out to the little rebel that lives within. The one who made you daydream as a kid about owning a chopper, chroming it out, and chewing on toothpicks. Just to look tough. For you, champ, Geico insures motorcycles with great rates. And to further fuel your engine, you can access your policy anytime, day or night, through the Geico mobile app. Because Geico knows that even make-believe renegades need help from time to time.
Geico Motorcycle. See how much you could save.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're having a great conversation talking about the FLSA new rules. We're talking with Commissioner of the Department of Labor, Jean Paquette, and Pam McGafflin. She's the Director of Bureau of Labor Standards. We're having more fun than three people should be allowed to have, don't you think?
Oh, yes.
I mean, I'm even sitting here, and my producer's even going, how do you guys keep all this in your heads? And I go, that's a great question. Because it's filled up there, Debbie, with lots of things. None of it that important. That's it. Once I remember my wife's birthday, anniversary, And anything else that requires me to remember for my wife. Those are the things that should be in the brain, but they're not. Right? All right. So we're talking about the FLSA. One of the questions that have come up, and you're hearing it a lot, I know, and the questions we're hearing is in regards to public employees versus private employees versus nonprofit employees.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jean, please talk to me about that.
Okay. I have heard that people are assuming that they can figure this overtime issue out by just letting people take comp time, which is compensatory time, which is not the case. Comp time is not allowed unless you are a public sector employer. And even then, you really need to take a look at how you're using the comp time rules. Comp time, if you really look at it this way, where you're controlling the hours, for example, if you have someone who has worked 10 hours on a Monday through Thursday, then by controlling the hours so that you don't need to pay overtime, you tell them not to come in on Friday, but you don't call it comp time. Okay, you're just as the employer controlling their hours. As far as nonprofits goes, I think that there's a little bit of confusion out there because when you work in a nonprofit, a lot of times you wear a lot of different hats. And so the assumption is that nonprofits would still be considered more on the side of public employers and allow comp time. That is not true. They are held to the same standards as private employers with this new rule, and so they really need to focus in on making sure that their employees are classified properly.
You know, I got to tell you, nonprofits are probably the area where who are most concerned, if you want to say, about this new rules, because they do have individuals who work a lot of hours,
yes,
typically, and sometimes for amazing causes. Let's
right.
not, you know, let's, I mean, let's get to the bottom line. There's amazing causes out there. So, Pam, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I've actually had a question from a nonprofit this week that they were under the understanding that they didn't have to adhere to the new rule because they were a nonprofit. And I think where that confusion comes also is, under the FLSA, there are coverage levels, meaning that if you're not covered under the FLSA, an employer has to establish a coverage level. And one of the requirements under the FLSA is that the business has to have an annual dollar volume or sales that exceed $500,000 or more. So they're thinking as a nonprofit that, well, they don't have sales, they're nonprofit, but it's the annual dollar volume. So if they have money coming in, even though that's dispersed out in charitable ways, if they have $500,000 coming in that's on the books, they're going to be covered under the FLSA. And then if not under the FLSA, you have state law that says if you have one employee, regardless, if you're a for-profit or nonprofit, you're covered under state law. So this is going to impact those nonprofits. And one of the concerns that this one nonprofit had is that, you know, if I have to start paying overtime to all my employees, it's going to really drastically impact the services that I perform as a nonprofit. So, you know, because I have to pay for the cost of labor, so therefore the money has to come from some pool, some pot of money, which means the services I provide to the community could actually greatly suffer because of this rule.
There's no question. That's the reality.
So it's a domino effect.
That's the reality of it. You know, I know there was a lot of comments made to the federal DOL about this, and probably my understanding is the most in history that have ever come in on a topic.
And we participated.
Yeah, it was close to 300,000, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's a crazy amount. They did seem to take some things into account. They did lower it a little. They did, you know, keep the duties test the same, which would have been a real issue had they done that as well, right?
Correct.
In terms
Very
of
much.
That. Now, are there any concerns that there are going to be any more final rules coming out prior to December 1 that could, you know, change or modify or anything before we actually go down this path?
I, at this point, have not heard of any addendum to this rule coming out. I know that there's a lot of people that have had some concern and would like to have it changed. We're in an election year, and so what I've been hearing is that the December 1st deadline is going to be the deadline, and there's people that are concerned about it. I know that Senator Collins has also had some thoughts about putting in a bill that would maybe extend it, but I haven't heard anything that's set in stone yet.
I think employers just really need to prepare for that December 1st, 2016 yeah. deadline. And because enforcement could occur immediately following. I mean, obviously, December 1st, there's not a violation. Somebody has to not get paid for something for a violation to occur. So you're looking at potentially end of December, you could have a violation. Something. I mean, you're only talking 30 days. I would really say the uptick is this going to be is probably 6 months from December. So you're talking June, July. This time, if you want to say next year, you're really going to start seeing some enforcement action because employers, due to ignorance of the law, just did not make those changes that they should be making, and there'll be a six-month look back at that point in time.
I certainly know that, as we've been talking, the main DOL is looking at the regulations and statutes or anything that has to be modified.
Yes.
When do we expect that to be coming out? End of summer, like in September, as people look at that?
Well, it depends. If it's potential new legislation, then we have to wait for the next session, which would be January of 2017. If it's a rule, then we have the authority to be able to change those rules.
These rules are routine technical. They're not major substantive, so they do not have to be presented in front of a committee. But there will be a public comment period. I mean, there are procedures that have to be followed when you do change rules. But these rules are routine technical. So the agency as a whole, under the discretion of the commissioner, we can make those needed rule changes hopefully before December 1st if we can accomplish that task.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's the main question, right? Is there anything more we need to be concerned about when if we're following the federal rules? And you know, the only example that pops into mind is the one we're talking about in regards to commission and bonuses, right?
Right.
The question, if that's a rule that – so that everything aligns, so that everything in the state and federal law aligns.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's really the question that people want. They don't want to have to say, okay, for 3 months until we get the legislature, and gosh knows what happens when we get to the legislature, is everything going to be lined up for that period of time? That's the question.
Yeah, really. The other problem is that rules can't supersede the law, so we can't change the rules completely to adjust to the FLSA if it supersedes what's currently in statute. Then we have a problem there. We would have to go in front of the committee.
Okay. One other question that has come up is in regards to the federal contractors. And so they do have unique issues that sometimes come up in regards to this. Is there anything that you're aware of regarding this law that changes anything having to do with any federal contracting guidelines?
No, and Maine Department of Labor does not oversee your federal contracts, meaning your Davis-Bacon, your Service Contract Act. Those are regulated solely by USDOL. While we do have state prevailing wage contracts that we do monitor and oversee and issue those contracts, regardless if it's a federal or a state contract, this would impact those too. So if you have a superintendent on a construction site that is on a federal highway project or on a state project, and you're paying that individual on a salary, you're going to need to make sure that salary is now $913 a week and that their duties still go in line with, let's say, the executive exemption. And they're not going to fall underneath a professional or admin. It would have to be executive. You're still going to have to make sure that all those align correctly. So this will impact bidding contracts under the prevailing wage for the state or on the federal side.
Okay. You know, I want to switch gears for just a second, unless you have something else you want to bring up on the Fair Labor Standards Act. Talk about minimum wage for a minute, because obviously this is coming up as a big hot button issue for 2016. You talk about the election, Gene. Here it comes.
Yep.
Does the DOL have a position having to do with the upcoming minimum wage, you know, that's coming up?
It is a referendum question. We tried to get a competing measure passed. That did not pass. So we are with this referendum decision. I believe that the minimum wage is something that, of course, we want to take a look at it, but is it really the answer to helping people get self-sufficient and be able to sustain an income that will help them be prosperous in their lives? And I believe that that is not necessarily a minimum wage change. I also think that when we try to mandate a change in the minimum wage, we do a lot of what I think is going to happen, a lot of damage to the entry level, younger entry into the workplace kids that want to try their first job. And if we're up to $12 an hour, they may not get that opportunity. So I think there's some unintended consequences with this referendum question. And so I think we have to really keep our eyes open to what reality is going to be and to the businesses in relationship to mandating a minimum wage. And the way the question is posed on the referendum, I think that we are also in a situation with some confusion around the tip credit. So I can let Pam talk about that for a second.
As Commissioner Paquette brought up about the miners, one of the things that the Bureau of Labor Standards also oversees is the work permits for 14 and 15-year-olds. And I could say on the average, my office approves and releases 3,000 a year work permit. So you're talking 3,000 14 and 15-year-olds who have a desire to work in Maine. Now you're going to tell me that 14-year-old, eventually when the threshold, when it reaches up to, in 2020, to $12 an hour, but that 14-year-old is going to have to be paid $12 an hour. There's going to be a lot of businesses that I've heard already that says, I can't afford. I mean, if it comes between a college student that wants to come back in the summertime, who's 21, who's got some business sense, I'm going to hire that 21-year-old. I'm not going to hire the 14-year-old because the value that I see is $12 an hour is for that older individual versus the younger. So as Commissioner Paquette said, you're going to see a shrinking younger workforce, even though, not to get into if 14 and 15-year-olds should work or not, but there's a process to protect 14 and 15-year-olds. That's why there's a work permit process. And as far as the tip credit, this referendum looks to phase out tip credits come 2024, which basically means, there's a misnomer there too. People say all the time that tipped employees don't receive minimum wage. That's incorrect. There is a requirement that under current law that the employer can take a credit of $375 against the tips. So that means their base wage is also $375. So it's a 50-50 type of split. So they're paid $375 an hour, and the employer can take a credit for the additional $375 against the tips. This looks to get away from that tip credit. So now you're going to have tipped employees come 2024 that are also paid $12 an hour. But does that mean they're going to get tips? Maybe not. The employer could probably put up a sign that says no tips. All my employees get at least $12 an hour. And there are a lot of, if you were listening to people give testimony during the legislative session when all these minimum wage bills were out, there was a lot of people that in the service industry that were saying, I make $40, $50 an hour prime time on the wharf in Portland. I do not want you to mess with that tip credit because I don't want to lose my tips.
Well, I find it interesting. This was exactly the conversation that happened in Portland when they went to try to have the minimum wage and they made an error, right, and had it messed with the tip credits and then suddenly had to repeal, what they had just put in. So, this is the same question having to do on the statewide ballot. It's just another way of saying the same thing. And so hopefully, based upon what we're saying here today, is that people will read and make their own opinions, but in terms of what exactly makes that happen. But a tip credit's a very important thing. For anybody who's done tips, they know it's an important area of revenue. And you can make a lot of money on tips. There's no question about it. If you're good, if you provide that service that you need. We're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB on 100.5 FM, and we will be right back. If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
Do you have acne or even the occasional breakout, with prescription-grade Proactive Plus, your acne can heal and you can prevent future breakouts. Try Proactive Plus 100% risk-free. Plus, get 2 free gifts and free shipping. Take it from me, Proactive really works. Get prescription-grade Proactive Plus, their amazing skin purifying mask, and a second gift of your choice. Totally free and free shipping. You're guaranteed to get clear and stay clear, or you don't pay a penny. Call now. 800-281-8770. 800-281-8770.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. Today we've had a great discussion about the Fair Labor Standards Act and all the changes. We've been talking with the Commissioner of the Maine Department of Labor, Jean Paquette, and Pam McGafflin. She's the Director of Bureau of Labor Standards. As we wrap up here in the last 3 minutes of the show, Commissioner, tell me a little bit about where people could get more information. You know, a couple of last-minute tips for those listening.
Sure. Before I give you the website information, I just want to say that overall, I think that there's a lot of great employers out there that are doing the right thing. And what I would suggest is that we really make sure that you communicate with your employees. Don't try to do this in a vacuum and then announce it the day before Thanksgiving, and then all of a sudden people have to go through the holidays with maybe a big change. So I think you have to really communicate with your employees, talk to your advisors, talk to your employment attorneys, your HR advisors, and also a couple of websites that I would suggest if you would like more information. The first one, it would be the U.S. Department of Labor's website, Wage and Hour Division, which is www.dol.gov/WHD. That will bring you to the Wage and Hour Division, and there is some fact sheets in that website. The other thing that I would like to give you as a tip is to make sure that you visit our webpage, which is maine.gov/labor, L-A-B-O-R. And don't forget, if you'd like to sign up for our employer newsletter, we'll be having ongoing information coming out on that. So please go to our website and sign up for that if you're not on already. Thank you.
No, I think you make a very good point. This is going to happen between Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Yeah.
It's a very sensitive time for employees. It's a very sensitive time. You're buying purchases for your family. Mm-hmm. It's an emotional time. And to add the stress to this and jump it at the last minute and suddenly say something, that could really cause trouble at your organization. So it really is something you want to think about now. Pam, anything else you want to throw in?
Just feel free to reach out to Maine DOL. We're here to provide as much compliance assistance on this issue as we can.
Awesome. You guys have been great. Of course, always welcome to come back to the show.
Thanks.
And absolutely go to the websites. Of course, people can go to the HRPowerHour.com right after the show. You'll be able to download this information, this show, and also provide the websites. We will put those links up there for you. Next week on the HR Power Hour, Brian Bouchard, employment attorney at Sheehan Finney. We're going to be talking about e-cigarettes, unisex bathrooms, prayer time, and other new accommodation requests, and how to respond. That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.